Dose up the mice. I knew you were finished, Lorenzo says, and hugs me, which feels wonderful and awful at the same time. I saw it in your eyes that day at Georgetown. Right. I wonder what else he sees in my eyes. Lynn, I need a minute alone here. She raises an eyebrow, but says nothing. In a moment, Lorenzo and I have the MRI room to ourselves. I have some news. Not very good news, I say over the banging. I don't know when or why I decided to tell him. Lorenzo's face goes as white as the walls. He punches the casing of the machine beside us, and the banging shudders, then steadies again. A flood of Italian cursing fills the room.
What is it, Gianna? What do you have?
No, I'm not sick. I'm fine. Well, I'm not fine, but... He checks all the corners of the room, examines the tile floor and the ventilation unit on the ceiling. For 5 full minutes, I'm standing in a sea of noise while Lorenzo combs the area around us. When he's satisfied, he comes to me, tangles his long fingers in my hair, and presses his mouth to mine. His hands roam down, stroking the nape of my neck, playing silent musical notes on my back. The skin under my blouse prickles and tingles, and now I'm in the kiss. All of me is lips and tongue and saliva and mute love, and it's not a Patrick kiss, but a Lorenzo kiss. I never want to leave this place. When we break, we're both panting. His hardness presses into my belly like he's probing to feel what's inside, what secrets I hold in that dark female place. It's moments before either of us speaks.
Is it mine?
He asks, moving slightly so there's room for his hand where that other part of him was.
Gianna, tell me.
I've already run these numbers, and I didn't need calculators or spreadsheets. 10 weeks ago was a cold day in March when I went to Eastern Market for a hunk of cheese and returned home with Lorenzo in my body after an afternoon at our little Maryland shack. Love shack, crab shack, baby shack. Patrick and I hadn't been together for a while. Yes, I whisper. He pulls me close. This time it's all softness. No edges, no probing, only a warm cocoon of lips and arms and our mingled breath. I'm safe here in this sterile room with its super magnets and banging and no cameras to watch us or recorders to pick up our sounds. For a few moments, it's only us. I have no children, no husband, only Lorenzo and the baby inside me, and a desperate need to stay like this.
I'm working on it, Gianna. He says into my ear. I'm working on it.
I want to ask what he's working on, if it has something to do with the money and the personal problem he talked about yesterday. I want to ask if he has a way out for me, for Sonia, for our baby. It would mean leaving Patrick and the boys, maybe only temporarily, maybe until they're able to travel and find me. And what then? Would Patrick take me in his arms this way? Would we return to normal in some new place? Would Stephen ever speak to me again? But that's foolish talk. There's no way out for me. Suddenly, every new bang of the machine is Jackie's voice saying, I told you so. I told you so. I told you so. 41. The banging of the MRI stops.
Okay, you two, Lynn says. Visitor. Good thing I looked up when I did. That Poe guy makes absolutely no sound. Zero. He's a fucking ghoul.
I uncoil myself from Lorenzo's arms with enough force to slam me backward into the wall. My ears ring with the monotonous thunder of the machine and Jackie's words. Lynn, cool as a cuke, takes me by the hand and leads me to the main area of the lab.
What the hell was that? Poe says. It sounded like the goddamned building was falling apart.
A magnetic resonance imaging, Lynn says. It's supposed to sound like that.
Poe grunts.
Why was it on? The other ones aren't on.
We only have one other one, I say, looking toward the first MRI room. Instead of responding, Poe starts a slow tour around the lab,
opening drawers and cabinets. He makes no sound, as Lin said, and it occurs to me that if Lin hadn't been here while Lorenzo and I were making out to the tune of a thrumming machine, I'd be joining Julia King on a podium, listening to Reverend Carl recite his morality tracts. We never would have heard Poe enter, not until it was too late. By the look on his face, this possibility has occurred to Lorenzo as well.
Morgan wants to see you in his office, Poe says, addressing me. Now.
I leave Sharon Ray's number with Lorenzo and Lin, telling them to set something up for Monday morning. With any luck, we'll be ready over the weekend, and I want Mrs. Ray in here as soon as possible. If I can give her a voice again, Sharon and Dell might be more receptive to the favor I plan on asking. In the elevator, Poe sticks his key card into a slot and presses the button for the fifth floor. It's the first time I noticed the slot, and I assume only the floors with our offices and the lab are accessible without a key. The doors open, and Poe extends a hand.
This way, he says.
The fifth floor corridor is plush, more like a five-star hotel than a government science building. My shoes make no sound on the thick carpet. Blue, naturally. As we walk, I read the names on the doors. General so-and-so, Admiral so-and-so, Doctor so-and-so. All men's names. A few of them stare out at me through semi-open doors. One scowls. Morgan is at his desk when Poe knocks. He calls, "Enter!" in a small voice he's trying to make big. I want to tell him it doesn't work.
"Where were you this morning?" he says, without looking up from whatever he's reading.
I had a family issue. A neighbor was supposed to look after my daughter, and... He cuts me off, closing the fat binder on his desk, moving a blank notepad on top of it so the label is obscured. Then he sits back with his hands behind his head, elbows pointing out. Maybe he thinks he looks bigger this way, more powerful.
"She," he says, "this is why the old way didn't work. There's always something, always some sick kid, or a school play, or menstrual cramps, or maternity leave. Always a problem."
I open my mouth, but not to speak. It just falls open in disbelief. Morgan hasn't finished. He picks up a pen and jabs the air with it.
"You need to get it in your head, Jean. You women aren't dependable. The system doesn't work the way it was. Take the 50s. Everything was fine. Everyone had a nice house and a car in the garage and food on the table, and things still ran smoothly. We didn't need women in the workforce. You'll see, once you get over all this anger, you'll see it's going to be better. Better for your kids."
He stops stabbing.
"Anyway, let's not argue about it. You be a good girl and get in here at 9 from now on, and I won't report this."
"I have Fridays off," I say. "It's in my contract." I need every bit of concentration to keep my voice steady and my hands still.
"Well, I changed your contract," he says, tapping a folder on his desk.
He still hasn't asked me to sit down.
"Before you signed it, and we're moving up the deadline to the third week of June."
"Why?" Now he's talking like a teacher to a small child.
"Jean, Jean, Jean, you don't need to know."
"Fine, Morgan, whatever. By the way, we'll be working over the weekend and running a trial on our first subject this Monday or Tuesday." I take a seat in the chair facing him. He looks shocked.
"Surprised?" "Well, yes. I didn't think..."
"You didn't think what, Morgan? That Lorenzo, Lin, and I could actually make this work? Come on, you were in the department with us. You know Lin's a rock star." I don't say, "You probably had to lower the chair in her office so your feet could touch the ground." It wouldn't do to piss him off, not when I need something. He studies me with those beady eyes, bright and alert, like a terrier's. No, that's not quite right. Terriers are clever little things.
"That's just terrific, Jean. Really terrific."
He stands up, an indication the visit is over.
"I knew we could do it."
I don't correct him. Instead, I drop my purse. When I lean over to get it, I can read the label on the side of the binder Morgan covered up. It's upside down, but the two words are clear. blue block letters on a white field. The side of the binder reads, Project Wernicke. 42. Poe, whose job seems to entail everything from site security officer to babysitter to office escort, is waiting outside Morgan's office to take me back down to the lab, and I follow him along the corridor of generals and admirals and doctors, along the blue carpet, to the elevator bank. Inside, he uses his key card again. I don't need the card to access the lab floor, so it must be the only way to leave floor 5. Of course it is, I think. They would want to know who's leaving, and at what time. Or they'd want to be able to block anyone from leaving. On the way down, I think about the binder I saw in Morgan's office. Altogether, my files, plus Lorenzo's and Lynn's, would fill several binders. We had reference materials, statistics, experimental designs, grant applications, progress reports, everything, the entire academic kitchen plus sink, the institutional review board documents, all the paperwork and disclosures and subject consent forms we collected to assure the university we wouldn't be running another Tuskegee syphilis scandal on unsuspecting prisoners, would fill a file cabinet on their own. There wouldn't be a single Project Wernicke binder. There would be 100, neatly housing years of our research. But Morgan had only one, and it wasn't labeled with a number indicating its position in a sequence. Also, the spine was broken. Morgan's binder was, evidently, well used. I think about this as the elevator begins its descent, while Poe stands silently behind me, slightly to my left. He seems not to be breathing. He's that quiet. First, there are 3 teams, white, gold, and red. That much I learned from spying in Patrick's study last night. Poe's slips about our team and the other MRI tubes make sense now. Other teams mean other labs mean other projects. Second, our equipment wasn't installed 3 days ago, no way. This machine, however large it is and whatever it encompasses, has been months in the making. Third, Morgan's binder has a broken spine. I catch my reflection in the polished steel elevator walls and realize I've been talking to myself. Poe is in the reflection too, dwarfing me. He has the slightest of smiles on his face, a sliver of a smile, and I think about what sharp teeth must be behind it, sharp enough to tear me to shreds without making a sound.
Here we are.
The voice shocks me. Its echo, cold and quiet, bounces off the interior walls of the elevator. I will the doors to open, and after a few interminable seconds, they do, onto the bone-white hallway of the lab floor. My keycard is still inside my purse, buried underneath lipstick and wallet and all the other crap my fingers find first. Lorenzo, I think. I need to find Lorenzo. My heel catches in the gap between floor and elevator. Such stupid things high heels are. Jackie always said they were as sinister as that old Chinese custom of foot binding. Fucking high heels, made by some asshole of a man to hobble a woman, make her walk 2 paces behind him, she said, twirling a sandaled foot while sitting on the sofa. But I'm not walking anywhere right now. I'm face down, half of me inside the elevator, half of me on the tile of the corridor, more than hobbled. Cheek to the ground, I can see the locked lab door only 10 feet away, and I scramble to my feet. A cold hand, heavy as a meat hook, grips my arm and pulls. I'm fine, I croak, or I think I do.
Careful, Dr. McClellan,
the voice belonging to the meat hook says. I'm up now, key card clenched in my fist, running to the main door of the lab, footsteps behind me. Poe isn't as quiet as he was. I slide the card into the slot. Nothing happens. There's a laugh behind me, a soft laugh that makes me jump and drop the key card. And that hand again, its long fingers digging into my shoulder, turning me around.
You all right, Jana?
I turn and sink into Lorenzo's chest. Behind him, the corridor is empty. Poe is gone. 43. We can't risk turning on the MRI machine again, so Lynn and Lorenzo suggest a different plan when I tell them we need to talk.
You're sick, Lynn says as we approach the security checkpoint. We're taking you out to your car.
She's to my right, pretending to support me, while Lorenzo has an arm around my waist. Our purses and briefcases are searched, and a uniformed man, Army, I think, but he could be a Marine, pats us down one at a time.
They're clean,
he barks to another man, and a light above the doors turns from red to green.
Have a nice weekend.
The soldier says this as if he hasn't just spent 5 minutes groping us, as if this were any other office building in Washington. The doors slide open, letting us out into the late May afternoon. Lorenzo doesn't let go of me, only holds me tighter, pressing his hip against mine. Someone is probably watching us from the windows 5 floors up, so I pause and bend over at the waist, hands on my knees as if I'm catching my breath. It isn't that difficult an act.
The projects are all color-coded, I say, keeping my focus on the asphalt. One red, one gold. The one we're on is the white team.
Morgan told you that?
Lorenzo asks. Right, I say. All Morgan wanted was to lecture me on how perfect the world was when women stayed home. No, Morgan didn't tell me anything, but he had a thick binder he tried to hide. Didn't work, of course. Morgan's twice as stupid as he looks.
Can you ask Patrick about it? Lynn says.
She's crouched beside me in the parking lot, her back to the building.
No, never mind. Can you get back into his study and have another look?
Maybe. Patrick's been drinking more lately, and it's Friday. I might be able to work something out tonight. I say this without really knowing where the words are coming from. They can't be mine, these spy-like thoughts. Jackie, maybe, would think up a scheme to get her husband drunk and pry his desk drawers open, but not Jean. In 17 years of marriage, I've never snooped around Patrick's papers, either personal or business, never looked for clues of a mistress or a one-night tumble. Once, when I couldn't find my planner, I thought I might have left it in his car. Even then, as I clicked open the driver's side door, I felt like an infiltrator.
We don't keep secrets from one another, babe,
Patrick said when I told him about the missing planner.
Never have, never will. I don't care if you go into my car. Snoop around all you want. You might find a dirty handkerchief in the glove compartment, though, so watch out. Cooties, you know.
He played lightly with his fingers up and down my arms as he said this.
Beware the Irish cooties.
Of course, I turned out to be the one with the secrets, or with one 6-foot-tall Italian secret. Correction, make that 2 secrets. One of them is about the size of a small orange. I'd better get going, I say. The drive out to Sharon Ray's Farmette will take the better part of an hour in traffic, and I want to stop in to check on Olivia King before dinner, call the hospital where my mother is, and don't forget, Jean, get my husband liquored up so I can steal classified government documents from his office. It's a tall order for a Friday evening. Lorenzo helps me into my Honda. Not that I need the help, but it keeps up the pretense. It also gives him the opportunity to talk to me without Lynn hearing.
Have you told him?
He says. No.
Are you going to?
He's a medical doctor. He'll know the baby can't possibly be his. Lorenzo's face distorts into a question mark. We weren't very active for a few months, I say. He relaxes into a smile.
I see. So there's no doubt.
None at all. I already feel the slight bulge, sense where the waistband of my skirt cuts in more than it did 2 weeks ago. Sooner or later, sooner, I think, I'll have no choice but to tell Patrick. He won't, in Stephen's words, rat me out. I know that. Even if he wanted to, the news would run the kids over like a freight train. That train would keep coming, unexpectedly, in the form of an intruder while Sonia watched cartoons, during a soccer match, in between CNN news segments. School, for them, would become a daily trek into hell. Patrick would know this, and he would keep silent. But the thing, that unspeakable it, will always hang over us like a storm cloud. No, that's not true. It won't hang. It will crawl and toddle and walk and laugh and be a living reminder of how I spent a cold March afternoon fucking Lorenzo and fucking up everything else.
That other matter I said I was working on? I may know something by Monday,
Lorenzo says, snapping me back to the parking lot.
Hold on until then, okay?
What is it? Lorenzo straightens, pulling his hand away from mine.
You two, a voice says. What's going on?
Poe is standing in front of the Honda, arms folded across his massive chest, aviator glasses masking his eyes. I hate Morgan, but the only person I'm scared to death of is this quiet giant named Poe. I manage a smile, throw the car into reverse, and back away without meeting his stare. 44. Never let a child visit a farm, I think, as I drive Sonia back home from the Ray's place. They'll want to stay forever. Sonia, only 2 days free of her counter, has developed the gift of gab. Non-stop chatter about Aristotle, the mayor, who is really a girl horse with a boy's name, Sonia informs me, is interrupted only by a narrative about brown chickens laying brown eggs and white chickens laying the normal white ones. She can't wait to go back tomorrow, and I wonder if I should have left her at the Rays overnight. No, it's better to bring her home. If Delilah Ray's trial goes well on Monday, I may not have more than a week's talking time with my daughter. I planned to ask Dell if he would do us the same favor he'd done for his own family, remove our wrist counters and replace them with decoys, but I haven't. Not yet. A small voice keeps reminding me of Stephen. He's drunk every flavor of Kool-Aid the Pure has handed him. Also, the twins might blurt something out, reveal the secret at school. I can't risk that. As we drive, the landscape changes from rural to suburban. All those houses, I think, are little prisons, and inside them are cells in the shape of kitchens and laundry closets and bedrooms. Morgan's words come back to me, his matter-of-fact talk about how things were better before, long ago, when men worked and women stayed in their private sphere of cookery and cleaning and baby-making. I don't think I really believed it would happen. I don't think any of us did. After the election, we started believing. Some of us became vocal for the first time. Women, for the most part, spearheaded the anti-Myers campaign. Women like me, who hadn't ever tried on a pair of marching boots, piled into buses and metro cars and froze in the Washington winter. There were men, too, I remember. Barry and Keith, who had 3 decades between them of fighting for gay rights, spent a Saturday painting signs at their house 2 doors down from ours. 5 of the graduate students from my department said they had our backs. And they did. For a while. It's hard to pinpoint what or whom we were protesting. Sam Myers was a terrible choice for the chief executive. Young and inexperienced in big-time politics, his military training a 1-year ROTC stint from college days. Myers ran his presidential race with a crutch under each arm. Bobby, his older brother and a career senator, supplied the practical advice. There was a shit ton of that, I'm guessing. The other crutch was Reverend Carl, the vote supplier, the man people listened to. Anna Myers, pretty and popular, didn't hurt the campaign, although in the end, it hurt her. Plenty. Our only real hope had been the Supreme Court. But with 1 empty seat on an already right-leaning bench and 2 more retirements looming, the Supremes didn't offer much hope. Even now, I'm told it will take months for the handful of restraining orders to make their way through the labyrinthine system, if they make it at all. Patrick tolerated my absence 2 winters ago, reheated batches of soup and other 1-dish meals, took care of the kids on weekends while I marched and phoned and wrote and protested. He didn't seem to require explanations or apologies, not like Evan King next door would have if Olivia had suddenly decided to be a poster girl against the administration. Patrick and I had an unspoken understanding of the direction our lives, my life, might steer if I stood silent. Tolerance didn't extend to those in charge, to the men Patrick works for. There were rumblings, and they were much louder than mine. One day, and I can point to it on a calendar, I often did during that first year after the counters went on, when the magnolias were pregnant with white stars, Patrick sent the children to bed early and led me out into the garden under the canopy of trees.
"I've heard things at the office,"
he said, holding me close, whispering.
"The administration is discussing ways to shut you up."
"Me?"
"All of you. So do me a favor and skip next week's march on the Capitol. Let the other women go if they want, but hang out in your lab, Jean. The work you've done is too important to..."
I slammed my palm into a nearby trunk, cutting him off. "And what exactly are they planning? Forced laryngectomies? Slicing out our tongues? Think about it, Patrick. You're a scientist yourself. No one can shut half of the population up, not even that bastard you work for."
"Listen, I know more than you do, Jean. Stay home with us this time."
Above us, a high wind whisked away the clouds. Patrick's eyes, soft and moist, reflected the naked moon. I didn't march that weekend, or any other. The next day, though, I told my gynecologist, Dr. Claudia, what Patrick had told me. I told Lynn and the women in my book club and my yoga instructor, everyone. The more I retold the warning, the more preposterous it sounded, like a bad science fiction tale, the kind of thing you see in movies. All gloom and doom, Dr. Claudia said. Never gonna happen. Lynn echoed this sentiment one day in her office.
"Simple economics," she said. "Imagine cutting the workforce in half." She snapped her fingers. "Just like that. Overnight."
"Maybe we should go away," I said. "Europe is better. I have a passport, and I can get Patrick and the kids their own. We could..." She cut me off.
"And what are you going to do in Europe?"
I didn't know.
"We'll think of something." "Look, Jean," Lynn said. "I hate the bastard. I hate all of them. But that Reverend Carl, he's a joke. Take a long, hard look around this city. You see anyone who actually believes his bullshit?"
"My neighbor does." She leaned over her desk, pointing a finger up in the air.
"That's a sample of one, Jean. One. You know more about statistics than to hang your hat on a single subject."
Lynn was right and wrong at the same time. My neighbor Olivia was an outlier, but she was an outlier only here in Washington. What Lynn didn't consider, what none of us considered, was how much of a bubble our city was, how different from the rest of the country with its bearded duck people and Christian communities cropping up like weeds. There was a documentary about one of those places, Glory Town or Gloryville or something like that, where all the women wore pretty blue dresses with high collars and followed special diets and milked cows. The director, when interviewed, had called it neat. Jackie had made the bubble reference first, that snide remark about me and my safe little lab, and followed it with an unhappy birthday to you basket of things that went pop. Bubblegum, balloons, sparkling wine. She asked me, it seems like a million years ago now, to think about what I would do to stay free. What would I do? Lorenzo has something cooking, I know. Something that costs quite a bit of money, more than he would have stashed away as a wandering academic. I don't dare raise my hopes that it's a ticket out of here, a stolen passport, anything like that. But I'm thinking exactly those things as I drive up our street past Annie Wilson's old house, now inhabited by one man and one boy, while Annie works long hours in some no-man's land. Extraordinary circumstances require extraordinary actions.
"Mommy, look!" Sonia chirps. "More lights!"
We're even with the King's house now, and this time, the ambulance is really an ambulance. 45. Julia King wasn't the first girl to find herself a victim of Reverend Carl's fornication police, and Olivia wasn't the first mother who watched her child being taken away in the middle of the night, only to reappear, transformed, on television the following day. Nor was Olivia the first woman to try her own way out. I've seen them in Safeway, the regular customers who disappear for a while and come back in a week, a little dopey in the eyes, the bandages on their wrists peeking out from long sleeves when they reach to a high shelf for that elusive can of peas or chicken soup. And there have been funerals, of course, not all of them for old men and women who died of natural causes. Evan's car was still in the driveway this morning when I left with Sonia. He'd stayed home, I assumed, to console his wife. Not that I believe Evan capable of much consoling. Possibly he stayed to watch her until the house could be suicide-proofed, or Olivia could be doped up enough so she wouldn't be tempted to try anything. I park and send Sonia into the house as soon as the gurney emerges on the king's front porch. Go to the den and watch something with your brothers, okay?
Why?
Why? Because Olivia King's body is on that stretcher. Because I said so, baby girl. Now. Olivia's body is on the stretcher, her face uncovered and serene. Her left arm dangles down beneath the white sheet, or what's left of her arm. The fingers are five charred stubs, black with necrotic tissue that crawls up her palm to her wrist, a wrist now the size of a baby's. I think even one of Sonia's infant bracelets would hang loosely on it, clattering against the exposed bone. An acrid odor fills the air, and stray wisps of smoke billow out their front door. Oh, God. Our own screen door bangs open, and Patrick catches me in time, just as my knees buckle.
It's okay. Don't look, Jean. Don't look at it.
It. Always it. Inside, he pours me a drink and tells me the kids are watching a video.
No television today. Not after.
He pauses.
I'll tell you about that later. Drink this.
What happened to her? My own voice is thin and string-like. I take a sip of scotch and it burns. Patrick pours himself a glass of the same, not his usual afternoon beer, and steadies himself against the kitchen counter.
Evan said he'd thought of everything. Locked up all the knives, anything sharp. Took away whatever she might use as a rope, even shut off the electricity.
Good thinking, I say. But he forgot something, didn't he?
After lunch, Olivia said she was going to lie down for a while. So he stripped the bed and took everything out of the bedroom that she might, you know, use. Oh, Jesus, Jean, I can't.
He swallows a long draw of scotch.
Okay. She had this little recorder, see? One of those dictaphone things, maybe from when she used to work as a secretary, I don't know. Evan heard her talking when he went to check on her, but she didn't say much, only a few words about Julia. 20 or so words in all. Then she went quiet, and he figured she was sleeping. You don't want to hear the rest, Jean. I swear you don't.
I have to. Another draw from his tumbler of Dutch courage, and he continues.
He went out to the garage to find some boxes. I don't know, maybe to pack the knives in or something. He didn't say. He thinks he was gone about 10 minutes when he saw the smoke from their bedroom window. They kept it open a crack, even though it's warm. I guess they liked the fresh air. I don't know, Jean.
Patrick's voice starts to tremble.
It's okay,
I say, laying a hand on his. He tips the bottle again.
She made a loop, you see? She recorded 20 words and made a loop out of them on the dictaphone. Then she put the gizmo out of reach and set it to play. Over and over and over again. If she even knew what she was doing after the first of the charges, she wasn't able to get to the machine and turn it off. Oh. Oh, no.
Patrick falls onto the counter, head in his hands, still talking, although his voice is muffled.
Evan said when he came into their bedroom, the recording was still playing. Same words over and over. I'm so sorry, Julia, it said, and all the time it was burning her, that goddamned metal monster on her wrist, eating into her skin until...
I run a dish towel under the tap, wrap a few ice cubes in it, and lay it over the back of Patrick's neck.
Shh, be still for a minute. When did it get so bad, Jean? We're doing everything we can, but when did it get so fucking bad?
We. A moan, No, a low, animal-like sob comes from the living room. I leave Patrick at the counter, the towel on his motionless head, walk through the dining room, and crane my neck around the corner toward the front window. Stephen is there, watching as the ambulance reverses down the King's driveway and takes off, sirens blaring. My son's shoulders undulate in a jerky, arrhythmic pattern.
She'll be all right, I say, coming up to where he stands, but still keeping some distance.
Nothing's all right, Stephen says. This is not the right time to talk about making beds and lying in them, so I stay silent.
You have no idea, Mom. You have no idea what they said about her today.
He watched it at school, the broadcast of Julia and Reverend Carl.
About Julia?
Stephen spins around, and his face is a picture of horror, pale and drawn, puffy around the eyes. His nose is running, and he swats at it with a sleeve.
Who do you think?
All of a sudden, he's 5 years old again, sniffling and crying about a scratched knee or a palmful of road rash from when he tipped his bike and went skidding to a stop. So much for sullen 17-year-olds.
Want to talk about it? I say. They didn't act like that with the lady down the street. Remember her, Mrs. Wilson? They just yawned while she was on television.
Another sniff, another sleeve wipe.
Maybe because she was old, or they didn't know her. But they all knew Julia. We all went to school together before it all changed.
It, I repeat.
So her picture came on the screen, and Mr. Gustafson told us she was the kind of girl we all had to watch out for, because she had the devil in her and would drag us down. You know, like, to hell.
Jesus, Stephen. He's composing himself now, pulling in deep breaths and steadying his voice.
You know what he said?
I don't think I want to.
No.
What?
He said we should never call people ugly things, like whore and slut and harlot. But then he told us that some people deserve to be called that stuff, like Julia. So he made us scream at her while she was on television. She looked so small, Mom, so helpless. And they cut off all her hair, all of it, like a marine cut, you know? Mr. Gustafson said that was good. It's what they used to do to heretics during the Spanish Inquisition, and witches in Salem.
Stephen starts laughing, cackling almost. It's a maniac's laugh. He keeps going.
It gets worse. He went around the room, smiling, and he handed out a sheet of paper with the foulest garbage written on it. You remember that old thing about 7 dirty words? Well, they were there, and about 50 other ones. He wanted us to take out our notebooks and write a letter, one letter from each of us, to Julia King, using as many shitty words as we could. We were supposed to tell her she deserved whatever she got, to have fun breaking her back in the fields.
I don't flinch when Stephen says shitty. Compared to everything else he's telling me, profanity sounds like a goddamned lullaby. Did you do it?
I had to, Mom. If I didn't, they'd all think...
He stops short, and a smile creeps up one side of his mouth.
Evil triumphs when good men do nothing. That's what they say, right?
He's got the essence of Burke's quote, if not the exact words, but I know what he means, and I nod. Jackie would like that. 46. This is almost normal, sitting around the table amid boxes of pizza, Sam and Leo arguing about who has the best soccer team, Sonia educating us on the ins and outs of cow milking and stable mucking. If I close my eyes, Patrick isn't slumped in his chair, almost shrunken, and Stephen is working his way into a sixth slice, crust and all. There's chatter and arguing and interruptions, all that normal family dinner shit. Except it isn't. Patrick had more to drink than he should have. Stephen picked off the pepperoni on a single slice and made piles of it on the side of his plate. And me? Tiredness has become an endless song, a never-ending loop of exhaustion running through my head and my limbs, pulling me down. Then again, this is my chance. and it happened all by itself. I put Patrick to bed, no small feat given his bulk and my fatigue, and read Sonia a story. She's asleep before Winnie the Pooh gets himself stuck in Rabbit's house. Good for you, kid, I think. The little clock on her nightstand tells me it's 8. Too early for the twins to be in bed, and way too early for Stephen. I go to check on the three of them. Sam and Leo are teaching each other card tricks in the den, also a normal thing. Stephen, when I knock on his bedroom door, says he wants to be alone for a while. To tune out, he tells me through the thick walls. This makes me think of Olivia. You sure you're okay? I say. What I don't say is, don't do anything stupid, kiddo. Maybe he's read my mind. Maybe he's got more sense than I'm giving him credit for. I'm not gonna, you know. Nothing like having a little pre-bedtime suicide chat with your son, I think, and go find Patrick's keys. My husband has a nightly ritual, an hour in his study with a beer after dinner, teeth brushing, and, on occasions that have grown rarer over the years and as scarce as hen's teeth in the past 12 months, sex. At some point between his study time and crawling into bed, he locks his keys in a steel safe in his nightstand, the kind of box with a keypad you see in hotel rooms. Once he tried to pass off this sequestering as a side effect of his new job, but I know better. I know if he resigned from the advisory position tomorrow and went back to consulting for the AMA, those keys and drawers and boxes would still be here, just like they are in every other house. I saw Evan King going through the same motions last month on a night he forgot to roll the shade down. And Evan's not science advisor to the President of the United States. Evan's a fucking accountant for a grocery chain. There can't be much secrecy in that. It's Father Knows Best now, baby. All the way. Patrick skipped most of this locking and unlocking ritual tonight, but habit forced him to roll over, open the drawer, and punch in the 6-digit code he keeps more secret than a mistress. I heard the keys clang into their hiding place, and the electronic pulse of 5 more numbers before he slid the drawer closed and rolled onto his back, mumbling something about trying hard and needing more time. I filled a glass with ice water and set it on a coaster within reach, along with 3 aspirin for the morning. Then I went in to read to Sonia. In between Rabbit and Pooh and Tigger, I thought of those 5 beeps when Patrick locked the safe. 5 beeps, not 6. After checking on the boys, I slip off my shoes and pad down the hall to our bedroom. Patrick is snoring softly on his pillow, his chest rising and falling under the thin sheet. In the dim glow of the bedside clock, I feel for the brass drawer handle on his nightstand, hook an unsteady finger under it, and ease the drawer out along its runners. The humidity has made the old wood sticky, and a single finger isn't enough to get it open. My hand curls around the brass and tugs. Physics is a fascinating thing. I think of the times when I've been out for a drink with friends, in one of those bars where they serve beer in heavy glass mugs, except you find out, just about when the beer hits you in the face, that the mugs aren't made of glass, but of plastic. Some kind of composite that has the look of glass, but not the weight. You calculate the force needed to lift a pound or so of beer mug, and whoops, you've got a face full of lager. Drinking problem, you say, and start wiping. Well, now I have a pulling problem. The foot pounds I exert on the drawer would have been enough to unstick it. Would have, if the brass handle hadn't popped off. I fly backward, hardware in hand, and my head hits the floor. Patrick stops snoring.
What are you doing, babe?
He mutters.
Just tripped on the rug. Go back to sleep.
Amazingly, this works, and I wait a full 5 minutes listening to his breathing become shallower before going to the kitchen in search of a screwdriver. It's 9 o'clock by the time I'm able to pry the nightstand drawer open wide enough to snake my hand inside, feel for the closed but unlocked safe door, and get a fingernail into the crack. The safe swings open, and I palm the cool metal of Patrick's keys before pushing the drawer closed. Time to send Sam and Leo to bed. They resist, Sam telling me he's got just 1 more trick. Now, I say, and wait until I hear them settle. Then I walk to the end of the hall, to Patrick's locked office door. I have the lie already prepared, ready to go in case Patrick wakes up and finds me sitting behind his desk, rifling through stacks of papers and envelopes. After all, my mother's in a hospital thousands of miles away, the language center of her brain possibly damaged beyond repair. Of course I need to call, even at the late hour. Papa won't be sleeping tonight. But I'm alone. Me and my sticky fingers and Patrick's neatly squared piles arranged like paper soldiers in rows across his desk. Everything looks exactly the same as it did last night, and it would, since no one has been in this room today. Olivia's gruesome self-electrocution left no time for such banalities as paperwork. Attempted electrocution, I remind myself, trying to put the image of her burned arm out of my mind. Everything is exactly as it was, except for the manila envelope and its top-secret stenciling. By 11, I've been inside every drawer and cabinet, examined under the two fake Persian rugs, felt along each inch of baseboard molding for a loose board. Finally, I give up and lie back on the hard floor, head still pounding from my earlier fall. I'm so tired. Like, bone tired. It would be nice to stay here. Limbs stretched out and eyes half closed until morning. It would be nice, and it would get me in a shitload of trouble, even with the ruse of trying to FaceTime my father. I push myself up, willing my legs to take the weight, and go over Patrick's desk one final time, squaring up the stacks of reports and memos with flat palms. If he says anything in the morning, I'll tell him he tried to work while he was drunk. As the office door key turns in its lock, the other keys jangle together. I close my fist around them to keep them still and silent, and rack my brain for what they might unlock. There are three keys in all, one for the office and two smaller ones. I suppose one of these others fits the lock on the trunk in the attic, where most of my books are. But the smallest, with its round bow, reminds me of Jackie. We kept a key hanger, a kitschy little job Jackie picked up at a yard sale, on the wall next to our apartment door. She repainted it in a Native American motif, coloring over the paw prints and the text that proclaimed, "All you need is love and a dog," replacing the lettering with our names, door, and mail. I was always misplacing the mailbox key, she said, so from now on, the sucker gets hung up on the hook. I can still picture it, that tiny key with its round bow. When I'm sure Patrick's office is locked, and Stephen hasn't emerged from his room in search of a midnight bowl of cereal or a Snickers bar, I slip out the front door. Night air hits my skin, and it prickles, reminding me that I've been sweating. Next door, the King's house is blacked out, not even a porch light on. Of course, Evan had left in the ambulance with Olivia while the sun was still high in the sky. Perhaps he hasn't come back yet. I feel around the inside of the door jamb for the switch that turns our light off. Flip it, and wait for my eyes to adjust to the night. Above me, over the King's roof, hangs a sliver of crescent moon. It looks like a hook. Wiping the sweat from my palms on my skirt, I fumble for the smallest key on the ring. With one trembling hand, I find the lock on our mailbox, the steel container Del Rey peered into only this morning, finding a single envelope. The key turns easily, once I get it into the lock, and I hold my breath. What the hell are you expecting, Jean? I think. Top-secret government documents in your mailbox? And yet, under that fingernail moon that looks as if it might float down and whisk the house next door away into the night clouds, I see the outline of a manila envelope. 47. As of 2 minutes ago, my name isn't Jean. My name is Thief. Or Traitor, I think. And wonder for a moment what sort of punishment Reverend Carl and his pack of pure men might have set aside for subversives. In a world where women are sent to the Siberia of North Dakota for crimes as petty as fornication, where Jackie serves a life sentence in a concentration camp for homosexuals, surely there must be some fresh horror for women who steal state secrets. They'll take me away, that's certain. I'll never see my kids again, or Patrick, or Lorenzo. I try to imagine a life somewhere on what Cons used to call the inside, where I spend every new day watching the mental photographs of everyone fade and silver with time until nothing but the faintest outline is left. Or maybe I won't have to do that. Maybe my last image will be of the inside of a hood as a noose slips around my neck, or the gel-smeared cap of an electric chair is strapped firmly onto my shaved head, or a needle slides into my vein. No, it wouldn't be a needle. That would be too kind. The clock inside chimes 12, counting out my heartbeats. There's no need to count them. I can feel each beat in my ears like a kettle drum. But I've gone this far, so why not a bit further? I lock the mailbox after taking out its contents, only the single envelope, and go back into the house. Despite the still warm air inside, a chill runs up and down my arms, raising the flesh into a braille of goosebumps. We don't have it as bad as Winston Smith, having to crouch into a blind corner of his one-room flat while Big Brother watches through a screen on the wall, but we do have cameras. There's one at the front door, one at the back, and one over the garage, aimed at the driveway. I watched them being installed a year ago, on the day Sonia and I were fitted with the wrist counters. No one could possibly monitor every household all the time. There isn't enough manpower for constant surveillance. Nevertheless, I'm careful to keep the manila envelope flat against my body as I turn from the mailbox and slide back through the front door. Then I walk from living room to dining room and toward the half-bath at the side of the kitchen. It seems a private enough place. Inside, I sit on the floor, my back to the wall, and pry up the prongs on the metal clasp. The cover sheet is there, the same memo I read last evening. Under it are three separate sets of documents, each paper-clipped to a colored cover page, one white, one gold, and one red. I flip the white cover first, revealing an outline of my team's goals. Develop, test, and mass-produce anti-Wernicke serum. Behind this page, there are the usual Gantt charts, the project manager's tool of choice, stipulating deadlines for interim reports and clinical trials. The rest of the packet consists of the team's CVs. Nothing new here, but I note Morgan's curriculum vitae is only one page long, while the rest of ours span half a dozen sheets. I flip the pages back, square them, and adjust the paperclip before setting the white batch aside on the bathroom tile. The gold packet is almost a duplicate of the one for my own team. Under the yellow cover page, the goals read, develop, test, and mass produce Wernicke serum. More Gantt charts and five CVs, all documenting the publication histories and academic positions of various biologists and chemists I don't know, are also in this set, along with Morgan's credentials. So they're doubling up, hedging their bets, it looks like. Hell. It's typical government. Why have one team when you can pay for two? The gold set goes on the pile next to me, and I move to the red team's packet, expecting another redundancy. But this one is different. For one, its goal is singular. Explore water solubility of Wernicke serum. The team members on the following pages, all six of them, are also scientists, all PhDs. Below each name is a military rank and branch. I squeeze my eyes shut to the harsh light above the bathroom sink and think back to this afternoon, to all the doors I passed as Poe led me down the fifth floor corridor toward Morgan's office. One of the names, Winters, rings a faint but clear bell at the same time the clock in the living room chimes the hour. 1 o'clock. Carefully, I assemble the packets as they were, white, gold, and red. Before sliding them back into the envelope, I check the Gantt chart in the white set. The timeline, a color-coded horizontal bar chart of tasks, goes back to the previous year, to November 8th, the date our lab equipment was requisitioned. So I was right. The Wernicke project wasn't conceived yesterday. It was started 7 months ago. My legs don't want to stand. Their disobedient limbs all cramped and prickly with pins and needles from sitting cross-legged on the floor for so long. I lean against the sink and stretch out my hamstrings.
Jean?
The voice on the other side of the bathroom door is muffled, but it's unmistakably Patrick's. He knocks once, then the doorknob turns. I didn't lock it. I didn't think I needed to. Shit. Shit, shit, shit. Quickly, I turn on the tap, letting the manila envelope slide into the narrow space between the vanity and the wall. When Patrick opens the door, I'm bathing my face in cold water.
Holy Christ, babe, he says. You're a mess.
My reflection agrees. Sweat-smudged mascara circles my eyes. The cotton blouse I put on this morning sticks to me like a thin coat of glue, and my hair is either matted down or sticking out in all the wrong places. I twist the tap and towel off, smiling a little sheepishly at Patrick, who seems much less drunk and much more concerned.
Didn't feel so hot, I say. Must have been the pizza.
He holds a hand up to my forehead, a cool, clean doctor's hand, the skin of it pink and scrubbed. For an instant, I think of Lorenzo's hands and how different they are. I think of how Patrick's hands might not be as clean as they seem.
You never get sick, babe, he says,
and then, with a small laugh,
well, unless you're Prager's. You know, with four kids, that amounts to a full year of private bathroom time.
I try to laugh along with him, but my voice sounds hoarse, wrong.
You're not...
Patrick's eyes dart from my face to my belly, and he frowns. He's not stupid, and he's a doctor. Between the math and his textbook grasp of embryology, he must know it's impossible. Our sex life over the past several months means that I'm either 3 days pregnant or carrying around a beach ball.
Of course not, I say. I really think it was the pizza. Taste it off.
All right, then. Come on back to bed.
He takes my hand and shuts the light in the half-bath off, leading me out of my midnight reading room.
Be there after I get a drink of water, I say, and I might as well call Papa while I'm up.
When his footsteps fade down the hallway toward our room, I slide the envelope out of its temporary hiding place, backtrack to the front porch, and reverse the process of stealing. I stop in the kitchen for a glass of ice water and suck it down while I dial my father's cell number from memory.
Pronto,
he says, sounding not like my father at all, but like a much older man.
Papa, it's Jean. How's Mama?
His voice tells me everything, even before he says the words brain damage and that area that begins with a W and why can't I talk to her anymore?
Can't you fix her, Jana?
Of course I can. I pull as much confidence into my voice as possible, hoping it camouflages the telltale jitter I feel in my throat.
Soon, Papa. Real soon.
After one more glass of water, most of which I end up patting onto my face, I walk down the hall to our room. Patrick is snoring again. I lay the keys on the carpet, just next to his nightstand, and crawl into bed for 6 hours of sleep. 48. In my nightmare, the kids are gone. One by one, I see them taken away from me, their faces darkening and fading. Someone, Olivia maybe, or possibly a soldier, holds Sonia up amid a flash of camera lights. The twins wave, and Sam flicks a pack of playing cards in the air above Leo's head. 52 pickup, he says. Steven smiles a crooked smile and calls, later, Mom. He cocks his head to one side, as if to say he's sorry. And all the while, Patrick watches, saying nothing. This isn't really how my Saturday starts. Patrick opens the blinds, letting a blast of morning sun into the bedroom. The twins and Sonia march in with a tray smelling of coffee and warm bagels, smells that on any other day might get my appetite going, but today they bring another wave of nausea. In the middle of one cream cheese-smeared bagel is a single candle.
Happy birthday, Mom!
Four voices scream. I nearly forgot that I'm 44 today.
Thanks, I croak, trying to look hungry.
Where's Steven?
Asleep, Sam says.
The clock next to my bed glows a digital 911.
I told Lynn and Lorenzo I'd be in the lab by 10.
Blow out the candle and make a wish, Mommy,
Sonia says. I do it, dripping wax onto my breakfast, then heave myself out of bed and sprint to the bathroom. Back in a minute. Get Steven up. I want to talk to him before I leave for work.